Welcome to Reading, Writing, Rolling, Imagination and Fiction in the Age of Harry Potter. This is episode 6, our special episode about the annual Chestnut Hill Harry Potter Conference at Chestnut Hill College in Pennsylvania. Joining us for Reading, Writing, Rolling. I'm your host, Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2. On October 19th to 21st of this year, I met up with my co-host and resident expert on this podcast, John Granger, author of several Harry Potter books, including the Deathly Hallows lectures, when he and I attended the 6th annual Chestnut Hill Harry Potter Conference at the beautiful Chestnut Hill College. John, it was so nice to see you again at the conference.
Yes, feeling is mutual, Katie.
Tell us what brings you back to the conference year after year, because we saw each other last year there as well.
It varies, Katie. Sometimes it's a 727, sometimes it's a larger bird, but I fly into Philadelphia
okay,
every year.
Okay.
I fly into Philadelphia every year because for Chestnut Hill, this conference, because what our guests have put together is really the not only the only academic gathering for Potter pundits, but it's gosh, I don't know how to explain this. What Chestnut Hill is, that's what this show is about. But really, Chestnut Hill is both a breeding ground, if you will, for Potter scholarship. It's a place to meet and exchange ideas. It's a place to foster new scholarship. Really what Patrick and Karen have done at Chestnut Hill is create a space for serious academics, for newbies to the field, for those that really got lost in the movies to come back to the books. It's become a touchstone and a reservoir of potential and realized things. I don't go on and on and on about it, but really it's an annual must event. The hosts have been kind enough to invite me back. I've been everything from the featured lecturer to, a widget guy. This year I got to fill in a spot that opened up the last minute. But it's the place to be. And I think you'll get that from this conversation today, really what a dynamic and an important event it is every year for Harry Potter fans.
Yeah, I agree, John. I feel the same way. It hosts a variety of kinds of people and kinds of scholarship, and to me that's what's really exciting about it too. So, well, this wonderful gathering of Harry Potter scholars that happens at Chestnut Hill Conference and has happened for 6 years now showcases, as I said, a variety of disciplinary points of view. It has people who are very new scholars and more advanced ones, and this year, John, you and I ran into a lot of our, Harry Potter friends and made new friends. I felt like I did. And this included even some previous guests of the show, like Louise Freeman and Emily Strand, who are on episode 1 of Reading, Writing, Rolling. And they are going to join us again today. And also, if you remember Tracy Beeler from episode 3, she did her Dementors talk, which is fantastic. It's really cool. The conference also, I wanted to point out, has a high school section on Thursdays. The Thursday before, and they invite submissions of art and academic papers on the Harry Potter books and even offer scholarships to high school students as a result of that. Yeah. And then the full day of academic conference happens on Friday, and then on Saturday there's a festival in the town, which is also a lot of fun. Now, dear listeners, for today's episode, John and I have assembled for your enjoyment and edification a variety of people from the conference to give you a little taste of what was on offer, especially on Friday, but some of us can talk about a little bit about the festival on Saturday too. And we hope to whet your appetite, perhaps for next year, where you might join us at the conference. Let me introduce you to our guests for this episode. First, we are pleased to welcome to the show the originators and continuing organizers of the conference, Dr. Karen Wendling and Dr. Patrick McCauley.
Hello.
Hello.
Karen is the Associate Professor of Chemistry at Chestnut Hill College and has investigated connections between Harry Potter and Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials series most recently. And Patrick is Associate Professor of Religious Studies, also at Chestnut Hill College, and the author of the book Into the Pensive, The Philosophy and Mythology of Harry Potter, which is just a beautiful book. Yeah. Welcome to the show, Karen and Patrick.
Well, thanks very much. Thanks for having us.
How's everything at Chestnut Hill College today?
Well, we're getting ready for finals. We're into our last week of classes, and finals are next week, so things are very busy.
That's how it is here, too. We're sort of headed into that last week of class, and things are heating up. Well, in addition to organizing the conference, Karen and Patrick both presented papers at the conference, and we'll be talking with them some more about their particular interests in the Harry Potter series. Others of our guests were, like John and I, presenters at the conference, as well as, of course, enthusiastic attendees to various panel sessions. So let me introduce to you some of the other presenters that we've assembled for you today. Louise Freeman is professor of psychology at Mary Baldwin University in Virginia, and she's published many articles on psychological issues in Harry Potter and is doing research on how reading Harry Potter helps to promote empathy among college students. Welcome back to the show, Louise.
Well, thank you. We are actually in the middle of final exams here at Mary Baldwin, so as a professor, this is actually a little bit of a breather week. I'm waiting for my students to take their finals by the end of the week, and then next week we'll be very busy again. So good timing for me.
Okay,
least.
Great. Well, good. I'm glad that worked out. And finally, our last guest is Emily Strand, who's an instructor
Hello.
Of comparative religions at Mount Carmel College of Nursing, and one of the contributors to Harry Potter for Nerds, too. She wrote about Quidditch in that one, although her presentation was different at the Chestnut Hill Conference this year. She's also the author of the book Mass 101, Liturgy and Life. Welcome back to the show to you, too, Emily.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
So it was great to see all of you at the Chestnut Hill Conference in October in person, where we could chat with each other and sort of share our love of the Harry Potter stories. And I just wanted to start by asking Patrick and or Karen what the conference origins were and what your goals are for the conference as it proceeds through the years, and particularly what your goal was for this year's conference.
Well, Karen's gone into her lab, and she'll pop in from time to time. But what happened was that when Karen and I came on campus in 2008, Karen came in as somebody who had graduated from Chestnut Hill College and also someone who had graduated from the honors program. We have an interdisciplinary honors program here on campus, which allows students to take very challenging classes that span an entire academic year, both fall and spring. And so when we came on as new professors, the head of IDHP asked if Karen and I would team teach a class on science and religion. And we spent a year preparing it, and then we debuted it. And the first thing we did was try to find something that would bridge the gap between science and religion without necessarily being in either one. And so we landed on epic literature, originally the Odyssey, as a way of dealing with a narrative that could look at things from both a scientific and a religious standpoint. But then we introduce into the background of the course discussions, the Lord of the Rings, the Philip Pullman series, and then we finished the year with Harry Potter's series, because all of our students had already read the material, and that way we could assign 4,000 pages without having <much data. laughs> And what we were finding in the first 2 years presenting the course was that we had these wonderful students who were producing their best work in this final essay having to do with Harry Potter. And Karen and I would sit here in the office and read these essays, really bemoaning the fact that we were the only audience for them. And so we started talking about how we could set up something down in the central part of the campus where a larger audience could be assembled to start listening to these essays. And so Karen and I spoke with the students about that. And then Karen got the bright idea of looking around in the Philadelphia area to see if there were any professors who were using Harry Potter in their coursework. And we found about six people, and we invited them in about 6 years ago now. And we had 35 people attending a 3-hour conference that first year, but it got things going, and that's the origin of the conference.
Wow, and it's just gotten bigger and bigger each year, I guess.
Yeah, Karen and I work on it 365 days a year. We meet in Karen's chemistry office, and we work out the details. We don't have a huge amount of resources. The campus and the college are supportive of the conference, but the amount of money and administrative help they can offer us is extremely limited. So Karen and I really do everything from the moving of furniture to the producing of essays for the conference.
Right.
We're a top to bottom team.
Real labor of love, as they say.
That's the idea.
And so what was particularly your goal for the conference this year, Patrick?
Okay, so the conference is just finished its sixth year, if I have it right. I'm always thinking about the next year, so I almost said seven. And one of the things that even came up during conversation and debate at the conference is what it means for someone who is a working academic with a PhD and trying to get tenure, how dangerous it can be to out oneself as doing Potter scholarship. One of my favorite elements of the conference this year was Christina Phillips Matheson, who just got her PhD in children's literature, she wrote her dissertation on Harry Potter with Maria Tatar as from Harvard as her advisor, and everybody was talking about how difficult and dangerous it can be to take your academic prowess and expose it to your colleagues and peers that this is what you're working on. And it has been my focus for the last number of years to try to dispel these prejudices about turning to J.K. Rowling as a serious element of academic pursuit, and to make it less dangerous for academics to get in, because I have a feeling that just behind the curtain there are many, many very clever, very insightful people with a lot to offer with regard to insight into these this wonderful series. I'm trying to offer them a platform, a safe platform for them to be able to come here and add their perspective, because I think it's only going to grow, and all they need is a safe place to do that.
That's really great. I definitely feel that at the conference, that you're surrounded by people who love the books and who are willing to put that out there and use it in their academic and in their other academic lives as well. And I totally agree with you that we just have to keep pushing it more into the mainstream, and it will be there. The literature itself, I think, definitely holds up. So let me ask the various attendees and presenters who've joined us on our conversation on the podcast today, how each of you found out about the Harry Potter Conference at Chestnut Hill College, and why you decided to come this particular year. So let's see. Let's start with. We've talked to John a little bit about it. So let's start with Louise.
Well, I must have learned of the Harry Potter Conference through Hogwarts Professor's site. I can't think of how else I would have found out about it. I honestly don't remember how I first found out about it, but this was my fourth year to attend.
Wow.
And fourth year to present there. Actually, one year I brought some students to present, and that was a lot of fun, but I didn't bring students this year.
I want to interrupt, Louise. Forgive me.
Okay.
Something we didn't mention in the introductions is that Dr. Freeman and Emily Strand both write regularly at hogwartsprofessor.com. And brilliantly. So if they want to read more about what Louise and Emily are doing, they need to go to hogwartsprofessor.com.
All right. Well, thank you.
And shameless plug there.
Yeah, well, it's a really fun blog for anybody who enjoys real incisive commentary on what's happening in the Harry Potter books. And you can also see some fun stuff about Fantastic Beasts and things like that on it. So it is hogwartsprofessor.com is a great site of this together. So Louise, right, you were saying that this is your fourth year back at the Chestnut Hill Conference. What makes it different?
Well, these festivals are popping up all over the place. Most of us were at the one in Roanoke, the first annual one in Roanoke, Virginia, last summer. I coordinated the academic component of the Queen City Mischief and Magic Festival in Stanton, Virginia in September, and that is also an annual event. We're going to have that in September, and I expect all of you there.
All right.
So just to contrast those two opportunities versus Chestnut Hill, in places like the Roanoke and Stanton, the academic talks were a fun component of the festival for the general public. I mean, they came in, they might hear a talk, then they might go have some butterbeer, then they might go have their picture made with Hagrid, and then go listen to the Wizard Rock, or, you know, it's part of the festival, and, you know, they're really good talks. The fact is, if I showed up at Roanoke next year and gave the exact same talks I gave the previous year, no one would really care. It would be a different audience, a different group of people, and they would never have heard it before. I think it was something brand new and unique. Now, if I submitted the same abstract to Chestnut Hill every people would notice. And in fact, Patrick and Karen would stop accepting them because they are looking for a unique scholarship that is created specifically for this conference. And that makes a huge difference to have a conference. I mean, yes, people who are interested in Harry Potter turn up at this, but just a lot of the attendees are either students or professors or graduate students or other scholars who are specifically interested in Harry Potter and are coming there to hear something they've never heard before. And that's what makes a true academic conference different from a series of talks for the public.
That's wonderfully well put, Lou. I want to interrupt Louise again and say that she's spot on, that the uniqueness of there's some problems involved with just having a Friday for everything that happens in academia, but it's so focused. There's really nothing else going on in town that day or on campus. You get this full-on focus for, you know, 9, 10, 11 hours. And then the important stuff happens after the conference. You know, we all sit down to eat and drink. It's a remarkable event. But it's also in this geographical spot where it's easy to fly in or to drive to from all over the East Coast. Patrick and Karen, with some support from Chestnut Hill, have been able to keep the price so that it's easily affordable to people to come in. It's not a trip to Orlando with a $400 hotel room and tickets for the rides. It's not an academic conference. This is going to cost you close to $200 just to register. The nexus of all the things they've done right at Chestnut Hill, it's really hard to explain succinctly.
Yeah, I do think accessible. It's accessible to lots of different kinds of people with lots of different interests, and it's also financially accessible as well. I think it's the kind of thing that really anybody, you know, who has that interest in Harry Potter, you know, it's not, there's nothing prohibitive about the location or the cost or anything. It's really well managed, too.
Karen and I spent a lot of time working on that aspect. We are dedicated to what's called the Boyer model of academics, in which the voices of the public and the voices of the undergraduates and graduate students come together with the voices of the tenured faculty, and the conversation between town and gown is one of the central elements that we have tried to foster and incubate as we've gone forward through the years with this conference.
Yeah, I'd like to add that I think the accessibility is extremely important. Chestnut Hill is a small college, like Mary Baldwin, like a lot of the participants who turn up at this thing. And I think, you know, the affordability and the accessibility is one reason you see small colleges that may not be major research universities, therefore may not give their faculty and students a lot of funds to go to more expensive conferences. I think that's a lot why you see a lot of folks like that showing up at Chestnut Hill, and why, frankly, a lot of the scholarship in J.K. Rowling is being driven by people from relatively small institutions, which I think, of course, is a very wonderful thing. You know, in my introductory psychology class, we talk about something about the history of psychology as a discipline and how it evolved as its own disciplines from its roots in both physiology and in philosophy. And I always tell the students, you know, to really be your own discipline, you need three things. You need a conference, share their work. You need a society of some sort, a professional society people can join and communicate with each other throughout the rest of the year when they aren't at the conference. And you need your own journal. And so we've got the first one now. We've really got the conference at Chestnut Hill. And so I hope Patrick and Karen and their copious free time will be setting up the society in the journal next. Correct?
We've already begun talking about the idea of getting the people who are on this podcast and some of the other people that participate at a regular rate and start to put that society together. That conversation has been going on now for about 3 years. And Karen and I already have, we talked to a few publishing companies about the possibility of doing a journal. And that would be in existence if Karen and I had, you know, another lifetime or clone of some kind. We actually have the materials sitting in various piles to start doing that. But as we were approaching tenure, we just... we really wanted to get something off the ground as something we could put into our package. And we just, in order to run the conference, we just didn't have the enough time to put something together. Editing a journal, as you guys know, is something that you need, as you say, copious amounts of free time.
You know, financial resources, which unfortunately the small colleges also tend to lack those compared to some of our bigger cousins.
I have a feeling that somewhere out here in the blogosphere that there might be somebody who is a new professor somewhere who would like to make their name. And if they wanted to start to talk to Karen and I about working with us to produce such a journal or maybe the proceedings from the conference or something like that, I have a feeling there's somebody out there this is the exact right project for. But Karen and I at this point have no ability to put something like that together that would be in any way something that would really reflect the quality of the people who would participate in it. So we'd like to throw that out there. There might be somebody for whom this is the right project.
That would be exciting.
Yeah. Can I add one more comment with regard to the accessibility of the conference? Because I echo what everybody has said. And for somebody like me, this was my third trip to Chestnut Hill for the conference. And, you know, the accessibility, you know, this conference, more than others that I've been to, succeeds in getting the people off the street into the doors. And their presence makes it really, not to say it's not fun to present to other academic types, but it is so much fun to prepare a talk that is meant for both. That is academically rigorous, but then also, you know, is accessible to people. So for me, just that accessibility makes it just more fun to present at this conference. And I find myself, you know, thinking about ways to put things in a humorous way or using narrative and storytelling to make my points instead of, you know, just footnotes. So the conference just becomes a whole lot more fun because of that kind of diversity of perspective.
I very much appreciate that feedback. Karen and I consciously work to foster that element. Philosophically and morally, I'm opposed to the use of language as a way of excluding certain people from the conversation.
Yes.
And I really am in favor of academics who can take their education and expertise and do the additional work of making it accessible to the audience in front of them. And I find it very difficult to understand the people who would work in the opposite direction. And so Karen and I work very, very hard to try to get a situation in which the people who do come in, who may not be from the academic background, can find themselves welcomed, both in terms of the space, but also in terms of the rhetoric that they hear. That we got a lot of feedback this year from people who were not academics saying they very much felt like that they were nervous about coming in. And after having heard all the talks, they were like, I really did understand almost everything I heard. And that was a really wonderful experience. And we spend the whole year trying to work that out.
And Patrick, what you said in terms of the, I think that academia in general needs to be a better able to communicate with those who are outside of academia. And the Harry Potter world is, I think, a great place maybe to start doing that. And I love giving a presentation to people in, you know, witches' hats and Hogwarts robes. That's also a lot of fun. And I do think it behooves us to talk with everyone and to use, as you said, language that does not speak in code. That does not mean that we're an exclusive group. So knowledge is for everyone. That is my philosophy as well. So let me turn to the individual papers that you all were presenting this year, and you all presented some really fascinating papers here. Let me ask, I'm going to start with Emily, because although I know you for your Quidditch paper on Quidditch as a symbol set, which is a really amazing revelation, I think, about how it's, you know, it's not just the bizarre wizard sport, it actually is saying something in the whole story arc. But for this conference, your paper was titled "Said Hermione Earnestly, Harry Potter's Prose and Why It Doesn't Matter." So tell us a little bit about what you were doing in that paper.
Well, I felt like I was going out on a limb in a few different ways. So I'm a big Harry Potter fan, first and foremost, and, you know, I started doing, you know, academic work in Harry Potter from the place of being a fan, and, you know, listening to podcasts like this one and reading other people's papers and everything. But in that the time elapsed, I also wrote my first novel, and I did that in collaboration with the local writers group, and, you know, took the project very seriously and really tried to make it as good as possible and conform to the kind of prose standards that publishers and agents seem to be looking for. And so then after that experience of doing that, and that's just been in the past, you know, 2 years, I then started reading Harry Potter to my son, who is 6. And wow, I noticed some really interesting things going back and reading her prose and looking at, you know, just book one. And I'm reading in the first couple pages and I'm like, wow, that's a big info dump, Joe. You know, and info dumping is one of those things that you're not supposed to do, you know, in the first 5 pages of a novel. You know, you're supposed to like let the story unfold a little bit and then parse out the information as it is most relevant, you know, and doesn't slow the pace of your narrative. And, you know, and then I'm looking at all the dialogue tags, you know, which is the said, you know, this character, and then said this character with an L-Y adverb, you know, and this is like, you know, one of these things that you're just not supposed to do in fiction these days, you know, if you'd like to be published. And it really got me thinking. And then I was like, oh, well, it's probably just the first couple chapters. And then she sort of lets off that. Well, no, it's not, you know. And so, you know, so she continues to use these L-Y adverbs, and they don't really help. She doesn't need them because her dialogue is strong enough without them, but they're there anyway. And so, you know, so I started thinking, gosh, you know, this would be an interesting thing to address, because there's always been this sort of underlying tension between, you know, we've been talking about the idea that if you expose the fact that you're looking at these popular books in an academic way, you're kind of making yourself vulnerable to ridicule or criticism or not being taken seriously, you know. And so my question became, are some of these flaws in her prose part of what has kept Harry Potter sort of out of the more academic conversations, or marginalized those academic conversations about Harry Potter, and especially in terms of literary studies? And of course, we also know that she was rejected by a number of agents and publishers before she was picked up. So was this part of the problem? So my talk kind of dealt with all that. And I was really, I felt really out on a limb with it, because I was like, you know, what do you do? You're going to a Harry Potter academic conference, you know, with a lot of people who love Harry Potter a lot, you know.
and you're going to say it's not well written. That's right. No good.
and Patrick and Karen can attest that I sent 2 submissions, because I was really worried that people would be like, oh no, we can't let her get up there and say all this, because, you know, she's going to get rotten fruit thrown at her, you know. So I was pleased that they liked the idea, because it's very compelling to talk about it, you know. And then it, of course, it makes you wonder, if it has these flaws in it, you know, how did it get published in the first place? And why is it so popular? And do the aesthetics of the prose matter? And of course, ultimately, I think the answer is yes, but there are other things that you know, outshine these sort of surface level flaws in her prose. And then, of course, you know, she's got some narrative point of view inconsistencies that bother me as somebody who wrote a novel really trying to keep a very coherent narrative point of view. She kind of gets away with them, I think, if we look at her in the light of Jane Austen and what Jane Austen, the kind of liberties that Jane Austen takes with narrative point of view. So Rowling just kind of takes a page out of Austen's book and she sort of gets away with it so that they can pull off these twists of narrative misdirection. They have to kind of play fast and loose with a few of the rules. So that was what my talk was about, and it was fun. I got to make jokes and put up GIFs of confused looking cats. And we, you know, the other thing we did was we looked at negative reviews of Harry Potter by some literary types. And it's funny because these reviews, they don't just go after Rowling for her L-Y adverbs, et cetera, but they go after the fans that love these books too. So they're actually really insulting reviews to look at, but it was fun to look at them with a big crowd of Harry Potter fans and kind of poke fun at them, you know, poke fun at the elitism that's going on in these reviews, and how, you know, these people are just really out of touch. You know, Harold Bloom saying, you know, can 30 million book buyers be wrong? Yes. It's like, no, Harold. It's like, I mean, really, really, Harold. You know, so it was fun. It was fun to look at these things and know that, you know, it's okay to admit that our favorite books are flawed in some way, as long as we understand that these flaws don't, you know, they don't detract from the fact that these are really wonderful stories with amazing, believable characters and just seamlessly driven plots. So.
So Emily, let me ask you a little provocative question, because some people try to suggest, you know, that, well, what she's doing is children's literature, so it's, you know, it's not real literature, or it's got a lower standard of literary quality. How would you respond to people who would suggest that about the Harry Potter books?
Well, you know, I would probably address them the same way I address folks in my area of expertise, which is liturgy. You know, people who want a different kind of liturgy for young people, because young people are bound to be bored by what adults like, and adults may not like what, and it's a fallacy. It's just that, you know, C.S. Lewis said a children's story that can only be enjoyed by children is garbage. You know, it's not a good story at all if it can only be enjoyed by children. And I think, you know, I think Disney Pixar has proven this to be true in the kind of film offerings that they have produced in the last few decades. You know, it's the ones that can be enjoyed by all audiences that you know, are the real phenomenons that sweep the world, you know. So I just don't think that children's brains they're not fundamentally different from adult brains, you know, and they're what they like and their tastes. If it's going to be something that children enjoy, and stick with them, it's bound to be something that adults enjoy as well. So, and children don't need, you know, children have, they can't articulate, you know, the different things that they can, that they get from stories necessarily the way that adults may be able to, but they still are getting those things. And so to patronize, to talk down to your audience, and you know, that's kind of what those L-Y adverbs do. Every time you tell me the way somebody said something, you know, it saves me the effort of using my imagination to read how they said it into what they said, you know. So you know, a more sophisticated writing is going to really work to craft what the character says very carefully, so that you don't have to tell me how the character said it. You know, it'll be obvious from the characterization and the words that the character says that the character said it earnestly, you know. And Rowling does that. I don't know why she has all those L-Y adverbs. She doesn't need any of them. But you know, a child will be able to infer those things just as well as an adult can. It's really not a sophisticated process. It's just, I think, the ability to articulate it is more sophisticated. So So I would say, you know, good luck to those people who think that that children are satisfied with bad stories. Good luck when it's time for you to read a million books to your kids.
So your paper actually reminds me a little bit on that particular note of some of the things that Patrick, you were saying in your paper, which was called "On Being Young and Loving Books." So Patrick, can you tell us a little bit about what you were talking about in that paper?
Yeah, this will match up pretty well with what we just were hearing. I also study literature and religion, and but I come from a background in literary theory and critique, and there has been a long tradition of conversation about what makes for good writing. You know, what are the characteristics or criteria by which you can distinguish, you know, developing writers from real masters. And the comment we just heard about LY tags and have been used. And yet, I also come from a film background, and out in Los Angeles, a place that I went to and then left, the rule is it's good if people come to see the movie. You know, it's good if people come to love the movie. And it's bad if, no matter how much the critics like it, if you don't find an audience, there's a real problem there. And so I pay a lot of attention to the symbols that reach people and make them feel things. This is something that Paul Tillich said, that a symbol is only a symbol if it reaches you and affects you and touches you in some way that allows you to move on to the next level of your development. One of the things that I was, when I was teaching at another university, my students came in during office hours and referred to me as a muggle before I'd ever heard of anything by J.K. And I was like trying to definitely go over to my computer and Google the word muggle. But I noticed immediately that my students, who were often at a loss to care about much, were becoming passionately involved in this new series of books that hadn't really hit the mainstream yet, called the Harry Potter series. And as a person who really pays attention to what my students pay attention to, this was like discovering a secret gold mine. And so what I have been writing about is how the Harry Potter series reaches people and gets them excited to read 4,000 pages in a way that no other series had really reached them before, and did this to almost an entire generation. And I find that criterion something that is that needs to have more attention paid at an academic level. Why did so many people turn to Pixar? Why did so many people turn to Harry Potter? Why did so many people turn to, like, The Hunger Games and read it voraciously when, in my generation, nobody read anything voraciously? A few of us were reading Lord of the Rings on the side, but it wasn't an entire generation that was doing that. And so one of the things that I was focusing on in my essay was how there has been a tradition over the last 40 years in academia to try to ferret out the unacknowledged prejudices embedded in classics of the literary canon. You know, so you'd spend your time as an academic in literature departments or comparative literature departments, going through and trying to reveal the elements of sexism or the elements of racism or colonialism within texts that used to be regarded as wonderful, and you should give them to 17-year-olds. And so it's been called critique, this idea of trying to ferret out the power structures embedded within these narratives. And I am a big fan of trying to focus on that. However, I see it as a mere tool and not as a destination or as an endpoint in academic pursuit of the power of narrative. That, yes, we should spend as much time as we can trying to locate the negative effects of, say, sexist assumptions within a text, because the last thing we want to do is to give young women a book that's going to further inspire them to reduce their own perception of themselves as the hero in their own story. However, those same individuals have to be inspired to their own story through some epic narrative. And this has been one of the things that human beings have turned to for as long as there have been human beings. As somebody who's into literature and into religion, I have come to really respect the power of epic stories or hero stories to take a 14 or 15 year old and transport them into an image of themselves that allows them to amass courage to face a life that is not yet clear to them, but yet you need that courage to embark, to take that first step or maybe that 10th step. And at that point, we have to shift our idea about how we evaluate literature. We simply can't be left looking at literature merely as a storehouse of unrecognized prejudice and start again saying, okay, young people are turning to these books without our permission. They're turning to them on their own discretion and on their own agenda and their own agency and saying, I need books. I want stories to help me become inspired to an independent individual future that I can't yet discern. And I need these stories and these symbols to help me do that. And I will do it even if you tell me that it's loaded with prejudices. And so we need to start to ask, what kind of books, what kind of stories, what kind of narratives, what kind of movies, what kind of poetry helps young people and maybe people who are young adults to make those transitions from one step to another as they develop. And so I was calling out the elements of higher education who focus almost exclusively on this idea of critique and saying, look, it's time to start to include some more into the actual what is actually received in the heads of readers from these narratives, from these stories. So I was trying to bring that up.
I love that sort of focusing on the, why we love the books, and it's okay to love a book, and you don't have to solely focus on the critique.
Isn't it strange you even have to say that?
I know.
And that's one of the things that our plenary speaker, one of the reasons why I thought she might be a good choice for this year's plenary speech is because she's been writing about that. You really have to say that. It's okay to love books,
right?
Because it's become such a dangerous thing to say in academics.
And the plenary speaker was Cecilia Conchar Farr, right, from
that's correct.
St. Catharines University.
Yep.
And
they call it St. Kate's.
St. Kate's. And yeah. She also talks a lot about how people rewrite stories that they think kind of exclude them, which I also really like. That it's not as though people are ingesting them. You know, it's just because you love it doesn't mean you're just ingesting everything uncritically in itself. So that was a great talk that she gave too.
She was wonderful.
Let me move into, and I'll just ask John next, since we're on this issue of literature. You had the very provocative title, Lolita Meets Harry Potter. Was Vladimir Nabokov the single greatest influence on J.K. Rowling? And frankly, the idea putting Lolita and Harry Potter together, pretty bold, controversial.
Well, people are going to accuse you of setting this up, so we're going to go from Emily to Patrick to John, and it's going to be a seamless stream here. Because what I was talking about, here's Emily. I hope Emily's going to jump in and say, John's still trying to be the dean. But this conversation we're having about how to read these books still seems to focus on them as children's books. And this is, I think, and we talked about, Patrick mentioned this author at the thing that had studied at Harvard with Tatar, really, a leader in children's literature, and really that's been the only haven for Harry Potter scholarship has been children's literature, when the books as a phenomenon really aren't about children anymore, haven't been really since the third or fourth book came out. They've had predominantly adult readers. Rowling didn't write for children. She wrote for herself, and the agents that she had weren't children's writers' representatives. And you find out what authors that she really loved. The authors that she really loved were people like Jane Austen and Colette and Nabokov. She doesn't mention any children's writers other than E. Nesbitt, who is also writing parody of children's works while she's writing children's work. And sure enough, that seems to be what Rowling is doing, is especially as much as she's a student of Nabokov, is that she's not writing children's books. She's writing books that are accessible enough that children can read them, but the structural work that she does, her symbol sets, things that Emily's explored in Quidditch and I've talked about, and Patrick in his wonderful book Into the Pensieve, talking about the theological and mythological depths of these books, These are books that are not written as Goosebumps novels to be, you know, read and discarded, or even things like the Chronicles of Narnia with a fairly obvious or transparent agenda in terms of what they want the reader to take away. What I was talking about was this time to talk about Harry Potter essentially as parody, and in light of the formalism which informs the work of Vladimir Nabokov. And there's no way we're getting into that today. But it is to say that what we're doing in Harry Potter scholarship, especially now that Generation Hex is coming on, the third generation really of Harry Potter scholars is coming on, we need to move away from this kid-lit idea of Harry Potter and look at Harry Potter as serious literature written for serious thinkers. I'm all on board with Patrick in saying, you know, we've had enough of the cultural Marxism and the compelled speech and what's allowed to be said about books, so that, you know, what people actually read books for, what Mercy Eliade said people read books for, you know, some sort of self-transcending thing. Yeah, we don't want people to be limited and told what their story has to be about, but we also don't want to ignore the fact that they want to transcend themselves, that they're not secular boxes that are going to take on this secular agenda, because that's what we talk about in the classroom. Anyway, Nabokov is just that. Nabokov is the virulent anti-totalitarianism and anti-compelled speech. His whole point is defamiliarization. Take the normal thing and then make a knight's move. You know, everybody thinks you're going forward and you take a sudden jerk to the left or right. That's Rowling's narrative misdirection. That's what we need to be talking about, is how Rowling's sophisticated symbolism and structuralist work create the reader response inside these stories. All right, wait, I've
that's
rambled.
So it's all hidden underneath the said earnestlies.
That's right.
That's a way to make you think it's showing the parody element, maybe.
I mean, Rowling definitely has her insecurities as a writer. The whole Robert Galbraith experience testifying to that. And I think, as Emily said, she doesn't need to put these stunts in here, these stets in her arteries, her story arteries. But that it doesn't mean that you should be derailed when you see those things, as Emily says.
Let me ask, so Louise, you and I and my co-author on my paper were not so much talking about, I was sort of talking a little bit about the literary impact of Harry Potter, but you're interested in sort of its impact in other spheres. So Louise, your paper was called The Shared Text and Science, Potter-Inspired Names in Biology and Psychology. So tell us what are some of these Potter-inspired names, and what do you think's going on with that?
All right. Well, this was a different talk than I'd given in previous years, but I thought it was just interesting from a cultural perspective. I found five animals. Let's see, that's two wasps, a spider, a crab, and a dinosaur that have been given scientific names after Harry Potter characters or some sort of Harry Potter name or concept. And then two papers describing psychological effects using Harry Potter terms. So, for instance, calling the role of choice in cognitive aging, the Dumbledore hypothesis, in terms of his emphasis on choice. And then someone who was studying self-punishment called her effect that she had seen the Dobby effect after poor little Dobby, who felt the need to punish himself after he violated what were the rules of his society. But so what was interesting about this talk is when I submitted it, I had three animals and two psychology terms. And between the time I submitted the abstract and came and gave the talk, two more were brought to my attention. So
this is just the beginning of a trend.
The talk kept getting longer and longer, and I kept having to condense it more and more. But I just thought this was an interesting because scientists have always had great fun naming new species, and have been using popular culture as an inspiration for scientific names. That's nothing new. But what we're seeing with these Harry Potter names is a very explicit intent to attract attention to their field, to their area of science. For instance, the Indian team who named the spider Areovixia Gryffindori, because it was shaped like the sorting hat, the hat of Godric Gryffindor. They described this in the paper as they talked about why they picked this name, and they said it was an ode from the authors, meaning the authors of the scientific paper, for magic lost and found, and an effort to draw attention to the fascinating but oft overlooked world of invertebrates and their secret lives. So, I mean, the fact is, if you discover a new vaguely cone-shaped little spider in a remote part of India and give it a good Latin name, very few people are going to know about it beyond the select few that are interested in that sub-sub-sub-field of this particular subspecies of Indian spiders. But if you name your new spider Gryffindori after the sorting hat, people notice, including J.K. Rowling, and she tweets about you. And suddenly you're in newspapers all over the world, and so you have drawn attention to this world of spiders or this world of invertebrates, which is what you wanted to do. I think the most interesting case I found was actually one of the more recent ones. It was a team of researchers from New Zealand who discovered a new species of native New Zealand wasps. Wasps have a very bad rap in New Zealand because most of the species people know about are invasive species from Europe, and they swarm and they sting and they build these big nests, and they're considered pests. But these native New Zealand wasps are actually very useful. They do not sting and very helpful in insects. So these researchers chose to name this new species of wasp Lucius Malfoyi, yeah, because they wanted to, quote, redeem the reputation of native wasps. And so they chose the name Lucius Malfoy because they considered Lucius Malfoy a, quote, redeemed character in the Harry Potter series. Now, Harry Potter readers care enough about the series not only to notice when an article in the newspaper appears about this wasp, but then to actually start arguing with the author that he should have picked a different name because don't know that Lucius Malfoy is the best example of a redeemed character, and that, you know, they start debating about, you know, whether Lucius Malfoy was actually redeemed. And that's what actually started happening in the session that I was presenting this paper. And people had all sorts of other suggestions for names for this wasp, like Regulus Black, for instance. The trouble is Regulus is already taken. Regulus is the name of a genus of birds. Someone also said, well, Narcissa Malfoy would have been a better redeemed character than her husband Lucius, but Narcissa is already the scientific name for the species or the group of plants that the daffodils belong to. So some of the names were already taken. But what I really found interesting about this is that a lot of these names are not, you don't see people naming the species, you know, Harry Potter after Harry Potter himself, or after Ron, or after Hermione. A lot of the names are coming from second tier, third tier characters, or even non-characters, like the Sorting Hat, or there's another wasp species that was named after the Dementors. And people still know what these mean. They still understand what the scientist is trying to communicate in this name. And I think that's just a really fascinating phenomena.
It really is. And, you know, what strikes me is interesting about the names that are already taken. Of course, we know J.K. Rowling trolled through, like, the, you know, old-fashioned names of plants and scientific names as a sort of resource for her character names, and how interesting that it's kind of coming back around again, and people are using some of her names to name some of the new species.
Yes, yeah, yeah. What is that called? Life imitates art.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, I think when you think about the psychological the psychological namings that you talked about, you know, you sort of think that it provides you a little bit of a shorthand way to understand a particular maybe syndrome or disorder.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, these aren't formal disorders. You're not going to find them in the Diagnostic Statistical Manual. These are more like effects people are finding in being able to demonstrate in correlational studies or in lab experiments. Mm-hmm. But yeah, same idea.
Yeah, and I think it's when you talk about your title mentions the shared text, you know, this is a way to bring yourself into a larger conversation, and it does demonstrate the widespread, you know, knowledge that people have of, like you said, even side characters. Really cool stuff on a little bit of a different take, which I think is neat.
I really thought it was appropriate that by the time it was time to actually give the talk, I had 7 things to talk about. I had 5 animals, 2 psychology syndromes, so I had, you know, the perfect magical number there.
Oh yeah, absolutely. That's fun.
Now someone's going to come along and name a new species next week and ruin it all for
me. It'll be the cursed child. That will be the name of some new species, and it'll be number 8, which will be appropriate. My paper that I co-authored with a colleague of mine here at Marietta College was also on a psychological topic, and so I'm sort of dipping my toe into your field there a little bit. And go ahead.
That's fine. just to throw in, the talk, oh gosh, now I'm blanking on who gave it now. Help me out, John. Who gave the talk on Harry Potter scholarship and the different subfields that are related? It was the one where the PowerPoint broke.
Was that Joel Hunter?
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah. That's right. Boy. That's right. Yes.
What a marvelous talk it was.
I had him send me his graphs afterwards, and unfortunately, psychology is like the second lowest of all fields in Harry Potter scholarship. So I'm very, very glad to hear you're contributing.
Oh, right. Let's definitely add to that. I think there's a lot to say in that area. And in fact, my paper started when I heard my colleague in psychology, Dr. Mark Sabicki, who's a professor here at Marietta College, I heard him give a talk about terror management theory, which is essentially a psychological theory that's built on the idea that human beings, one of the things that makes us unique is that we're conscious of our own mortality, and this actually causes us to try to create various buffers to sort of shield us from that reality or to help us cope with that reality of our impending death. And after he gave this talk, I went up to him and I said, well, you know, this is all Harry Potter, right? This is all stuff that's in Harry Potter. And I knew that at least his daughter had read it. And he was like, really? And so we talked about it. And as we talked, we sort of developed this project together, and I've never actually even written a paper with somebody else before, so it was fun to work on it with him. We essentially were looking at not only, obviously, that the characters in Harry Potter, you've got Voldemort, who's literally trying to escape death, and we have these issues of mortality that I think are very front and center and pretty clear. But we were also interested in some of the advice that J.K. Rowling seems to be doling out about it. And the title of our talk is Death Meets the Three Brothers, Terror Management in the Harry Potter series. And we focused on this tale of the three brothers and the particular ways that through the gifts that they are given from death, those become symbols of ways that they are trying to deal with their eventual mortality. And through the Elder Wand, you can see that some people are going to try for displays of raw power, violence, dominance. Through the Middle Brother and the Resurrection Stone, you can see regret, living in the past, really an inability to cope with the reality of death. And it's the Third Brother, obviously, who demonstrates with the Invisibility Cloak the acceptance that he can only avoid death for a little while, but accepts death and then passes the cloak down to other generations. I was struck, Patrick, by what you said about the importance of symbols and symbols that people respond to, because I think that that's really what J.K. Rowling created with the Deathly Hallows. And the Deathly Hallows symbol has become really popular, and I noticed this just in the research for this paper. People use this as a tattoo a lot.
A lot.
And it's funny because it is not necessarily a wholly good symbol in the Harry Potter universe. Xenophilius Lovegood gets attacked by Victor Crumb at Bill and Fleur's wedding because he's wearing it, and it definitely has the emblems of a bad symbol, like a swastika type symbol. But people who are readers of the Harry Potter story are looking at that symbol, they have instead, I think, interpreted it as a way of dealing with mortality. And in fact, usually on the tattoo, it couples the symbol with Dumbledore's famous statement about death being the next great adventure. And so we sort of developed the notion that the invisibility cloak in particular, but also the whole Deathly Hallows symbol, was an important way that people were actually using the Harry Potter stories themselves as a kind of invisibility cloak, as a kind of buffer that helps them to cope with mortality and in psychologically healthy ways. So it was really fun to step outside my field a little bit and get into psychology. I enjoyed playing around in your field a little, Louise, although Mark Sabicki kept having to pull me back from various statements. He's like, psychologists would never say.
Well, I've been enjoying playing around in the literary field for a number of years now, thanks to my contacts on HogwartsProfessor.com and places like that. So it's good to know it goes both ways.
Yes, and I really love the ability to work in interdisciplinary fashion, as long as you're humble about, you know, the things that a person has to learn in that field. And historians, you know, we'll take everybody's methodologies and everybody's information and incorporate it into what we do. So that's just to give a little flavor of some of the things that we presented. I also want to just mention that Karen, who has stepped out to attend to her lab, she also presented a paper called A Comparison of Common Elements in Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials Trilogy and Rowling's Harry Potter Series. And I also think that we saw at the conference this year some really good matchups of people looking at texts together in conversation with each other. And that's one of the things that I like to see also at the Chestnut Hill Conference. There were a lot of people who were, you know, who were bringing sometimes unusual texts together and saying, you know, what is this? How does this help us understand what's happening in Harry Potter or for fantasy literature, what have you? So I really like that move.
Well, I had to ask. I didn't get to see that talk because I was in another session, obviously. But did she bring up John's hypothesis that Philip Pullman inspired the character of Gilderoy Lockhart? Did that come up at all at her talk?
No, she did not. But John brought it up because John was in that audience.
That goes without saying. I don't think that's news to anyone. But
it was a fascinating talk. Karen, first rank scholar here. I mean, it's funny. She comes from a family of literary wonks. She's sort of the
she the black sheep.
That's
chemist.
Right. She's the black sheep chemist. I think she's really an alchemist at heart. So it was wonderful to hear her talk about Pullman. And she gave a very positive review of what he does inside the books. Though before this was really a revisiting and a revisionist approach to Philip Pullman, because he has largely been, especially in the United Kingdom, has been rejected as a pair with Rowling, that the two of them supposedly are in opposition. Hence this theory about Gilderoy Lockhart being modeled on Philip Pullman, because personally he's a lot like Gilderoy Lockhart, and he has his novels have before his most famous trilogy featured a character called Sally Lockhart, so it wasn't an especially big jump to make. Karen's talk, as Louise was saying, and Katie was saying, brought this thing back together for another look, which was jarring and very positive in just like, oh, I thought we had this guy already pigeonholed and resolved in terms of his relationship with these stories. Karen brought it up with an entirely new spin, to me at least. Very impressive work, as always, from her.
Yeah, it's a really interesting paper, and things that You know, very, it's in a way, it's very, there's very material or process oriented things going on in both books that are pretty similar. So that was really, I think that was very inspiring. And I thought I would just open up the conversation to all of our guests here to talk about, you know, what were some of your favorite presentations at this year's conference that you saw other people giving? And we can, you know, just sort of give some short impressions of those.
Well, mine is probably the shortest. I'm going to stay loyal to my discipline here and say, Katie, your paper was one of my favorites.
Oh, good.
To see the more psychology. But also, in the same session, there was a paper by Yasmin Miranda on bibliotherapy and depression.
Oh, I love that one, too.
So, as many of you know, I have actually written an article on psychological disorders in Harry Potter. About half of that article is talking about depression, personified by the Dementors, and the Patronus charm as cognitive behavior therapy. But it's very interesting. Yasmin's talk took the approach that the, you know, simply thinking happy thoughts with the Patronus charm was actually not a very good approach to depression, which was kind of a very different way of looking at it for me. And she also brought up a character that I had never considered as being an example of someone who is depressed, which was Draco Malfoy in The Half-Blood Prince, as he is going through his year of torture, trying to figure out if he can possibly, you know, kill Dumbledore or not. And I thought that was just a really nice example. And you look at the character, and, right, he is actually showing all the symptoms of depression, isn't he? And so it's, again, another nice example of, you know, getting a different perspective at a conference like this. And it takes us back to the reason for those types of conferences in the first place.
Right. And there was a big conversation about that in the discussion period after that, too. And I think it's the kind of thing that drove people back into the books, because some people were saying, oh, that's movie Draco, and that's not the book Draco. And so I think, it's the kind of thing that returns you to the text, that kind of conversation. So what are some of the other favorites that you all had when you're thinking about the conference presentations that you attended?
So I attended Christina Phillips Matson's talk, Say the Magic Word, Spell Work and the Legacy of Nonsense. Mm-hmm. And I was just so excited about that title, because I'm really, I love thinking about nonsense words and, you know, the underlying power of human language. And the, you know, for my field, the sacramentality of human language, you know, the way that words are these signs of these, you know, interior realities, these material signs of these interior realities that, that are so important. And so I was kind of hoping she'd get more into like the spiritual understanding of language and everything, but I understand why she didn't. But I was really excited because, it really dovetailed nicely with some of the work that I've done, on sacramentality. And so we got to talk after, you know, at the lunch break about all that. And it was just one of those talks that, is why I love Potter studies, is because we do end up, you know, verging into each other's disciplines, like we've just been talking about, you know, delving into disciplines that are not our own and having to work really closely with others, of various disciplines to have this conversation. So I really enjoyed her talk, and I was really surprised, I shouldn't say I was surprised that I enjoyed it, but Lauren, is it Camachi?
Yes.
Her talk on alcohol was, I was really fascinated by that. And this is the second time this has happened to me this year, where I've gone to a talk about something that I assumed was insignificant in Potter, like alcohol. I mean, it's just there. It's part of the world. It you know, it shows up here and there. It doesn't mean much. Sometimes it's a humorous device. But gosh, Lauren really convinced me that it has more significance than I ever gave it credit for, in terms of a plot driver and also a character flag. You know, characters who are slurping alcohol tend to be bad characters. You know, and then of course with Hagrid, you know, it makes him sort of an ambivalent character. You know, it points up one of his many flaws as a character, is that occasionally he gets sloppy drunk, and so I don't know. It's just the way Lauren pursued it made it seem a lot more significant than I've given it credit for. So,
and that talk was groundbreaking in other respects. I mean, she's building on other scholarship, but she talked pointedly about the fate free will issue, that everyone assumes that Rowling is totally on board with choice, that it's all about what we choose to do and what we choose to become is what we are, and neglect the giant background of fate and prophecy and how everything seems to be working out exactly as predestined. That there's a balance to these things, and she brought that up, that alcohol was sort of the same thing, that people assumed they understood about what was going on there with the booze, and in fact there's a much more ambivalent and rich and textured use throughout this thing. I mean Katie did stuff like this with the house elves, and this is really what's exciting about conferences like Chestnut Hill and the scholarship which is being incubated and fostered at places like this, is that we're getting into the real depth of these looks. And that paper I was supposed to present, I forget if I was immediately before or immediately after her, and I just wanted to sit there and chat with her. I mean, I just wanted to hear more about where she was going, because all of us only had 20 minutes, you know. And so she opened up this fascinating subject that we definitely could have talked about all day. And we had to move on to Nabokov, you know. I mean, we had you know that explosion. So as I'm with you, Emily, that was an unsettling and mm-hmm. a wonderfully unsettling talk that she gave.
Right, just she had a really fun title of the talk, and so I just thought I'd put it out there. It's called Frisky Risky Fire Whiskey.
Good.
And one of those things that I didn't remember reading much that had to do with alcohol in the books, and then when you start to hear her talk about it, you're like, oh my gosh, it is definitely worth noting.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to chime in that Lauren is a long-time partner with the conference. She showed up a day early to help with a lot of the finishing touches and to get the conference off the ground this year. And Karen and I can't express our appreciation enough for all that she did to help us get things to the finish line this year.
Another that I think is something I hadn't really thought about struck me as just unusual. I saw a talk from Melinda Rice, who's an MFA, called The Wand and the Stick, looking at Rowling's wands and violinists' bows. And she looks at some of the ways that violinists talk about their bows and the personal characteristics that they have and the connection that they feel with certain bows. And it was really fascinating. I hadn't realized that, but it has something to do with material objects that you use in it as an instrument, and the way that you become attached to them, and they develop meaning for you. What a really interesting talk that was.
Two talks that had me, you know, my mind going in 10 directions I didn't expect them to go to, which is why I go to Chestnut Hill. One was one that was mentioned earlier, which was Joel Hunter, came in all the way from Arizona and gave a talk where he gave I had just finished a lit review for the thesis work that I'm doing, and Joel presented where he did a quantitative study of the critical literature which is available, and tracking it through time, tracking it by category. It was a remarkable piece of work. We're talking about 3,300 refereed or, you know, serious pieces of scholarship that he categorized. I mean, just think of the hours that were involved with this. He had PowerPoint issues in the presentation, so he lost, you know, 9/10 because they left because they didn't want to see the guy give this very visual presentation without his visual aids. But I think of the talks that were given, Dr. Hunter's may be the one that we as Potter pundits wind up referring to more than any of the others, because it'll give us some picture of, you know, the field that we're in.
I really hope he publishes that soon in an actual journal, so he can read it and refer to it, because it's going to be very, very helpful to a lot of people. I actually had to do a lit review of all the psychology papers that have ever been published on Harry Potter for a paper I was asked. It was one of the things I was asked to add to a paper I was writing, and boy, that one field was challenging enough. I can't imagine trying to review are trying to look at every paper in every discipline ever written. It's just amazing.
So I also thought I would just mention a paper that I really enjoyed by Talonda Henderson. And it's partly that it deals with historical topics and memorialization, which is something that I'm interested in these days, but a really very interesting paper called History or Propaganda: Memorials in Harry Potter. And she talks about particularly the memorial to the house where Harry Potter's parents lived and he lived that got destroyed by Voldemort, and how it's been preserved in its, you know, decimated state, and how there is a memorial up there. And I really did not even remember that there had been such a thing, but she did a really great job explaining the importance of that as a symbol, and the importance of its emotional impact on Harry when he encounters it as a memorial. Obviously, memorials are something that we're talking about a lot in the United States today, and frankly, it's a way that we have people in the popular realm interacting with history, or at least with social memory. And so it struck me as just such a great example of that that was here in this book, and I can't believe I had to be reminded of it.
Yeah, I that was another one I was very sorry I missed. See, we need time turners on these things.
I know.
Being from Charlottesville, who of course had a major incident with exactly that issue last summer. I would have been very, very interested in hearing that. And again, please, please get these things published, because I want to read them as well.
Well, they were all recorded. Patrick, what are the plans for the recordings?
We have them all recorded. We have them going back a number of years now. And so we have a nice little mountain filled with gold that we want to do something with. But as we were saying before, it's a matter of trying to get somebody who has the technical and educational expertise to be able to put something like this together. The other issue is that we have to go back and try to get, you know, waivers of the rights to have all of these things put into a different position. So it really is going to require somebody who can spend the time to do the legwork of getting up there and putting these things together, editing them, and getting the permission from the original authors. But we have, you know, we have 6 years of the stuff. We are at this point, we've talked a little bit about whether or not we want to put them online, but a couple of you have said during this podcast that there's something very, very magical and special about being together face to face in physical presence with everybody at Chestnut Hill during this conference. And we are absolutely committed to remaining as analog as possible in terms of people being in the same place at the same time, talking to each other who are physically present. We think that's an important element of the conference. And we are a little worried about putting things online and kind of diluting the intention of people to travel from, as you mentioned, California or Arizona, Mississippi, to come up here and to have this, you know, one day where we're all together talking. So we're trying to work out how we're going to do that. We have it all kept safe. And it is going to find its way somehow. But at this point, Karen and I are already, the two of us always do overloads even, and we don't get a course release to do the conference. And so we're trying to find a way to do it. But we have every intention of what you're asking.
One of the great things about the conference is being physically with all of these folks who love Harry Potter too and who are interested in it at this level. And some of the conversations that you have with people, Emily mentioned, you know, just over lunch talking with somebody whose paper she'd seen, and that just happens all the time. And those kinds of conversations that are spontaneous, and I just think they're so enriching to be able to just have that opportunity right there at the conference.
I'm very glad you said that Karen and I spent the last 3 months prior to the conference, we received some feedback over the last number of years about how we put in like a half an hour here or 15 minutes there, and we got feedback that people found them very enriching, as you said. And so we actually reshaped the entire structure of the day to extend and the moments of time where nothing was being presented, and so that people could have these spontaneous conversations while we were playing music in the rotunda and that kind of thing. But and we even added that section at the end where the entire conference was invited to come together to have an open forum discussion with a panel, because we wanted to increase the amount of spontaneous conversation with everyone physically present. And we've gotten a lot of feedback since then about that really being part of the their favorite elements of the conference is the unscheduled time.
I think that the addition of the music and all of those sort of more social events, I love the debrief at the end. I thought all of that was, you know, that's really important. We know that when we're teaching our classes, we should bring that into our understanding of how conferences work too. So
yeah, that was a major agenda this year, that we wanted to expand that element of the conference in whatever way we could. We spent a lot of time moving the chessboard around to maximize that.
One of the things we haven't really talked much about, but there were a lot of papers about, were actually people who are using the Harry Potter novels in their classroom. And I did want to mention Brent Satterley's paper about him using it in a social work class. I saw him last year, and then I saw the follow-up this year. And it just seems like it's a text that has a lot of meaning for people. This may bring us around full circle to, you know, texts that have meaning. And this is the whole reason that this conference developed anyway, was that this is a text that people already have a relationship with. And so people are bringing it into a variety of classroom settings as a way to enhance teaching and learning, and I just think there's a lot that's exciting that's going on in that area as well.
Well, I can say as a Potter pundit, you know, the senior citizen on the set here, that one of the great takeaways for me is having the idea that it's all been done, that we know everything about these books. You go to Chestnut Hill to have that idea exploded, you know, profoundly. I mean, shattered. You can't leave that place thinking, "Oh yeah, I didn't really learn anything this year." When every place that you went, the different perspective, the different insights. I want to mention Caitlin Harper's talk about the Weasleys. Part of me was thinking, what can she possibly say new about the Weasleys? I should have known from what Caitlin's done with Quidditch that I was about to have my world turned upside down. And sure enough, just as one part of the talk, she went into the differences between Fred and George, who, forgive me, you know, in my mind, Fred and George were almost like clones. That they were actually distinct characters, though twins, was not that I carried around in my headcanon, as Emily's taught me to say. Caitlin Harper, however, detailed that Fred and George are remarkably different people, and that are consistently portrayed as these characters, so much so that you almost wind up, you may be like their mother to start, and you can't tell them apart, or you think that you know them, but after you heard her talk, you could pick up anything. You would not even need an adverb to know what they meant after their verb of speaking, but you would know who was speaking just by their almost their tone of voice as you picked it up from the text. And that freshness, that revitalizing thing for the books, to me is invaluable.
Absolutely. And you know, I thought so. We are far beyond our normal hour time here, but it's such a fun conversation, it's hard to stop. But I thought maybe I'd end on a question for everybody about where you see Harry Potter going, where this conference might go. What are some future directions that you are excited about seeing in the future for Harry Potter scholarship?
Well, as far as emerging trends, I see three right now. Fantastic Beasts is getting lots of praise. Cursed Child is getting bashed. And Club Red Strike is still being ignored.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, bingo. Mm-hmm. in the critical, I mean, that's the public trend, and that's critically important because I think criticism largely follows that. I mean, we're seeing some fascinating things right now in Fantastic Beasts about the Maledictus and Nagini. Mm-hmm. I mean, Beatrice Groves just wrote something on Hogwarts Professor that was mind-blowing the other day about the Maledictus is actually a word that's used in Genesis to describe the serpent. It goes back to the whole Lilith tradition inside this that Rowling seems to be very much aware of. I mean, fascinating stuff. I mean, there's been more interesting stuff done on studio news releases about Fantastic Beasts than there's been done at all about Cursed Child, or really Cormoran Strike. Though we've written some fascinating stuff about that nobody seems to care about. the critical trend I'm seeing is maybe this is my hope for thing is that we're moving away from the kid lit this idea. That this meme, that unexamined idea that Harry Potter is children's literature, I think it's nonsensical in terms of the audience. I think it's nonsensical in terms of the quality of the writing. I think it's a parody, a la Nabokov, of actual children's literature. And I think that we're finally beginning to get a move away from that, which will represent a sea change in Harry Potter studies. But it still is the, you know, the dragon in the room, if you will, the dragon in the library, that Harry Potter has to be understood first as children's literature, when it quite clearly is not.
So Emily, what do you think about new trends or future directions?
Well, I was really interested to see the, call for papers that Cecilia Contrafar put out, after the conference the last few weeks. It's been floating around, and it's interesting that the focus of the book is going to be literary treatments of Harry Potter, purely literary treatments of Harry Potter. Again, you know, with some obviously allowance for these different perspectives within literary critical studies, you know, eco-critical, you know, race and gender theory, etc. But that there's this real push to maybe within the field of literary studies itself, and not, you know, all of the other fields of us interested scholars like mine, theology. There's been some good stuff done in our area, but to look at this as a subject of worthy literary study, and I think that we're going to see more and more of that. That maybe folks, and you know, and John, I've talked to John, and you know, he's done the more thorough a review of what's out there, and there are those studies out there, but I think that these more interdisciplinary studies have gotten more attention, or have, I don't know, those of us outside of the field of literary studies are less worried maybe about being taken seriously, you know, with this kind of scholarship. We look at this as more of a way to engage the person on the street in an academic conversation. But I think in literary studies, there's been more of, they've hung back a little bit more, and maybe that's prudent, but now it looks like that's becoming more of a focus and something that's okay to do. Again, you know, we see with Christina Phillips Mattson, you know, she had to, you know, kind of, you know, and these are her words, she had to sort of hide the fact that she was going to focus on Potter when she applied to her graduate program. And then when she got in with Maria Tatar, she was able to embrace it more. You know, so I think that this is good. This is an important trend among others that's happening in Potter studies right now.
Great. Now, Patrick, what are your thoughts, especially as somebody who's part of the conference or one of the conference organizers? What are you seeing as a future trend?
Well, first of all, one of the things that Karen and I are noticing is that the conference is, I don't even know how to say this, it's stabilizing academically. We're every single year we're getting more master's level and PhD level proposals. And one of the things that we noticed as conference coordinators this year is that even though people were still showing up with some costumes and we have no problem with that at all, but we found that this year more people stayed to the bitter end than ever has before. And there has been, there were fewer people registered for the conference this year than last year, but the people who came were more adamant about maximizing how many papers they went to see, and they almost none of them left. And so even though fewer people registered, the conference was more full than last year or the years before. And there were, you know, every year there's an uptick in people who are willing to throw their hat in the ring and say, yes, I'm presenting publicly on this. And so I'm finding, and that, I think, Christina Mattson, right? Did I get that right?
Yeah, I think it's Mattson.
All right. So one of the reasons I asked Conjure Afar to be plenary this year is because she is in a very small cohort of academics who are really sounding the alarm with regard to the limits of this style of literary interpretation called critique. And the key figure, I think, at this point is this woman down in University of Virginia, whose name is Liz Felsky, who wrote a book titled The Limits of Critique. One of my colleagues here at Chestnut Hill applied for a position years ago at a major university, and she was one of the finalists for the position. And when they finally told her that she wouldn't be offered the position in Spanish poetry, they said, well, the reason why we didn't hire you is because you believe in the literature that you write about, that matters to you. You care about what the author intended, and we can't have somebody like that here.
Oh, wow.
And literally, that is an unaffected true story about what happened. And there's more going around about that than anybody in the English departments knows what I'm talking about. And so there's a movement toward, I think, through religion departments and the study of hermeneutics, that, you know, where people use text to try to interpret the meanings of their lives, is a rebirth of the conversation between the reader and the author at the locus of individual human meaning. I think there's a lot. I think that's one of the reasons why there was a phenomenon, and I think that's one of the reasons why so many people do all the hard work it takes to get to an in-present conference like we have at Chestnut Hill every year. That this rebirth of the conversation, the relationship between the reader and the author at the locus of meaning, is, I think, where things are going.
This is a lot of what I think our podcast is interested in too, which is, you know, really thinking anew about literature and the effect that it can have on all of us in a variety of ways, and you know, being willing to embrace the text that we love and that, you know, have a certain, I don't want to say this too strongly, but that have a certain sacred quality to us as readers and in our own personal development and our identities. Well, thank you all so much. I am sorry to say we are out of time, but I wanted to give everyone a big thanks. Karen Wendling and Patrick McCauley, who designed this wonderful conference at Chestnut Hill every year, your hard work and the way that you devote yourself to this, I think, is wonderful, and I'm so glad that you were able to join us today. Louise Freeman, also Emily Strand, and of course the always daring John Granger. Thank you all for a robust conversation. That was really lively, and I hope that people were inspired by that in their own thinking about Harry Potter, but also inspired to come and join us maybe for the seventh Chestnut Hill Harry Potter Conference, which
we have a date.
I think it's October 19th.
So we'll stay tuned for that. There is a website for the Harry Potter Conference at Chestnut Hill, and so we encourage everybody to stay tuned for that. And of course, what we're talking about here is Harry Potter as a shared text for the 21st century, and I think that our conversation really demonstrates the ways that the Harry Potter series is becoming embedded in the way that people think and learn and our understandings of ourselves and the world that we live in. I also wanted to give a big shout out to our technical editor, Emma Nicholson, who is in Australia, and also to all the folks Hooray! At MuggleNet who make this podcast possible. We appreciate your support. And so with all our wonderful conversation in mind and considering the varied and nurturing friendships that a mutual love of Harry Potter has allowed me to cultivate, I would like to end this podcast with a slightly different quotation from my usual one. It is also from Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore.
Nice.
In The Goblet of Fire, he says, "Differences of habit and language are nothing at all if our aims are identical and our hearts are open." Please join us next time for another episode of Reading, Writing, Rolling, where our aims align and our hearts are open to the magic of J.K. Rowling.